A listener note, this episode contains references to violence that may not be suitable for all audiences. It's July 27th, 1981 in Hollywood, Florida. It's a sweltering summer's day, and 33-year-old Reveille Drew Walsh is happy for any excuse to get out of the heat. So a little after noon, she heads to the mall to pick up a pair of lamps she's seen in the Sears catalog. Tagging along is her son, Adam. In green shorts, yellow flip-flops, and a white captain's hat, the 6-year-old boy is hard to miss as he trots through the department store at his mother's side. On their way to the lamps, the pair walk through the toy section, at the center of which is a big screen television with the latest video game console attached. As usual, Adam tugs on his mother's hand and asks if he can stop to play. There are plenty of other kids milling around, each waiting for a go at the game, so Reveille figures Adam will have at least some company while she picks up the lamps. She points toward the furniture corner of the store, less than 100 feet away, and tells him that's where she'll be. After a few minutes of waiting, a salesperson tells Reveille that the lamps she wants aren't in stock, so she leaves her name and phone number and returns to the video game, expecting to find Adam. But he's not there. None of the children are. Trying to stay calm, Reveille wanders through the aisles, looking for adults she can ask for help. But there's little anyone can do beyond suggesting places for Reveille to look. As the minutes tick by, she starts to feel that something is very wrong. Adam is not the sort to wander off, despite the store employees suggesting that's probably what happened. Through it all, Reveille is terrified to venture far from the toy section. She's hopeful that Adam will come back to the spot to find her if she just stays still. Eventually, Reveille is relieved to see her mother-in-law walking past the store. Together, the two of them venture out into the mall and start dashing into other stores to ask if anyone has seen Adam. Reveille remembers she has a photograph of him in her purse and shows it to people, hopeful it will trigger a response, but it's no use. After 2 frantic hours, everyone in Sears knows Reveille is looking for her son, but it's clear that Adam Walsh is gone. Someone calls the police, and a pair of patrol cars roll into the mall parking lot shortly after. The officers write down some details, but don't seem terribly concerned, at least not to Reveille. It feels like no one realizes that her 6-year-old son has vanished. Though no one seemed overly concerned at the time, in the days that follow, news of Adam Walsh's case will spread rapidly, and soon almost every parent in the country will seem to know his name. Adam's disappearance will affect far more than just his family. The Walsh's story will raise the profile of missing children throughout the United States and shatter the illusion of safety that permeated much of the 20th century after the search for Adam Walsh comes to a heartbreaking end on August 10, 1981. From Noiser and Airship, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is History Daily. History is made every day. On this podcast, every day, we tell the true stories of the people and events that shaped our world. Today is August 10th, 1981, the murder of Adam Walsh. It's August 10th, 1981 in Central Florida. A pair of citrus field workers walk alongside a drainage canal off the Florida Turnpike. The two have just been fishing in a nearby river and are chatting about the day's haul when one of them catches sight of something in the water. He slows his steps just slightly and squints against the bright sun, trying to make out what's floating at the surface. Bewildered, he points the object out to his friend, and after getting as close as they dare, they both agree it looks like a human head. Until that moment, the scent from the nearby citrus groves floated in the air, perfuming a perfect summer day. But now the fishermen notice the smell from the canal seems more prominent, like there's a stench of death in the air. They rush to the nearest phone to call the police and hope they're wrong about what they've found. Less than 24 hours later, Reveille Walsh and her husband John are in New York City, preparing to speak to millions of Americans. It's been just over 2 weeks since their son Adam vanished from a department store, but they're still hopeful they'll find him safe and sound. Since Adam disappeared, The Walshes have marshaled law enforcement to search for him and made plenty of noise to ensure everyone is on the lookout for their son. John is an experienced marketer and designed a simple but eye-catching flyer featuring a description of Adam, a photograph of the 6-year-old in his baseball uniform, and an offer of a $5,000 reward. They've printed close to 1 million of these posters to be hung in locations all across the country. They've also spoken to local radio stations and TV networks, pleading for Adam to come home. Now they're ready to call for help on an even larger platform. Today, they're getting ready for an appearance on Good Morning America, where they plan to speak about Adam. In addition to asking for viewers' help, the couple hopes to finally catch the attention of their son, wherever he is, and let him know that they are waiting for him to come home. But that's not all they're going to do. The mother of another missing child and a director for a missing children's charity are due to also appear on the segment with them. Both women have been trying for years to make the kind of progress the Walshes have, and they've asked John for help, requesting he hold up pictures of other missing children on air and help amplify their stories too. This is a moment that parents in their positions don't get very often, and they want to make the most of it. John realizes that as a man, he might be a more commanding voice to speak out for these children. No one seems to have paid attention to the desperate mother searching for answers, but perhaps things will be different if the plea comes from a father instead. So with their interview just hours away, the Walshes steel themselves to speak to a national audience. But before the car arrives to take them to the studio, a call comes through to their hotel room. It's someone from Florida who wants the name of Adam's dentist. Remains have been found about 130 miles away from Hollywood, and there's a chance it's Adam. But they need to compare the teeth in the found body to his dental records. A little after that, a television producer calls. They've also heard about the remains in the canal and want to know if John and Reve are still willing to go on air, or if knowing about the development, it might be too painful. John tells the producer that they'll go ahead with the interview. It's possible that whoever the police have found in Florida is not Adam, and that this interview might be the thing that brings their son home. Besides, he and Reve want to show the pictures of the other missing children and drum up as much publicity for their fellow grieving families as they can. That afternoon, hours after the interview, John is in his hotel room when another call comes through, and it's the one he's been dreading all day. They have identified the remains from the canal, and it is Adam. Despite the crushing end to the search for their son, the Walshes have started something larger, sounding an alarm that puts parents around the country on high alert. Over the coming years, John and Reve become fierce victims advocates, specifically focused on missing children. In October of 1983, a movie about Adam's case is broadcast on television and watched by 38 million people. After the airing, John and Reve show photos of other missing children and ask people to call a dedicated hotline with any information. The film airs again in 1984 and 1985, each time displaying more photos of missing kids. These efforts will lead to the safe return of 13 children, but they'll also contribute to the rising panic about child abductions in America. At its height, numbers will circulate that state 1.5 million children are reported missing every year, and 50,000 of those are abducted by strangers. But contrary to these numbers, the FBI only investigates 67 cases of kidnap by stranger in 1984. Still, despite statistics that should alleviate parents' fears, Adam Walsh's case will contribute to the dawn of a new era. From this point forward, children will be kept on tighter leashes, and the phrase stranger danger will enter the vocabulary of young families everywhere. And for the Walshes, the search for Adam's killer will continue. Though the rest of their son's body will never be found, the family will hold a funeral for Adam. But even after laying their son to rest, the Walshes will never stop searching for answers. It's October 21st, 1983, 2 years after Adam Walsh was abducted and murdered. A detective steps through the doors of Florida State Prison where an inmate has requested a meeting. In any other instance, the detective probably wouldn't have rushed over to the prison so quickly, but today is different. The inmate in question, Otis Toole, has sent word that he has information regarding the boy everyone's been talking about, Adam Walsh. Just under 2 weeks ago, the TV movie Adam was aired across the U.S., reaching tens of millions of viewers and raising the profile of missing children everywhere. In the 11 days since the movie aired, there has been renewed interest in the already sensational case. As the detective passes through the various security checkpoints, he wonders what kind of information Tool has to offer. Perhaps he's heard rumors about another inmate's involvement in Adam's murder and wants to see if he can make a trade for information. Then again, maybe he's just bored and looking for an excuse to leave his cell for an hour. Settling down in the cramped meeting room, the detective prepares a tape recorder and checks that his pen is working. Then he signals for the prisoner to be shown in. At 36 years old, Otis Tool is already a convicted killer awaiting sentencing for at least one murder and soon to face trial for another, a record more than enough to make the detective's hair stand on end when Tool shuffles into the room. The detective waits patiently as the guard shackles Tool to a bolt in the floor, then leaves. Once they're alone, the detective surveys Tool carefully, his thinning, straggly hair, his protruding ears, and discolored teeth. Then, with little preamble, Tool launches into a story, telling the detective in graphic detail how in July of 1981, he kidnapped, assaulted, and murdered Adam Walsh. The detective listens as Tool tells him how he used candy and toys to lure the six-year-old to his car in the parking lot outside Sears. After driving for a while with a frightened boy, Tool beat him, then cut off his head, which he threw into a drainage canal off the Florida Turnpike. Listening to this story, the detective is sickened. What makes it worse is how closely it matches the details of the case and how much it seems like it could be true. In the days following Otis Tool's confession, news outlets around the country announced that the murder of Adam Walsh has been solved. Investigators who have been working the case for 2 years confirm that Tool has long been their prime suspect and that this confession simply confirms what they believed but couldn't prove. And at first, it's a relief to know that the killer is behind bars, unable to hurt any more children. But that sense of comfort curdles as Tool keeps talking. Already facing the death penalty for one murder and a trial for another on the way, the prisoner keeps confessing to more and more slayings. If Tool's stories are to be believed, then he's responsible for over 100 murders. But proving his claims is another matter. Part of the issue is Tool's credibility. Many of his confessions are corroborated by Henry Lee Lucas, Tool's one-time travel companion and possible lover. But Lucas is notorious for his nickname, the Confession Killer. In his lifetime, Lucas confesses to over 600 murders, earning himself a fearsome reputation as the country's most prolific serial killer. Tool and Lucas back each other's claims, admitting to being accomplices for many of their partners' murders, which helps investigators close countless cold cases. But eventually, it's revealed that Lucas is just a cooperative interviewee who likely admitted to crimes as a way to earn perks like fast food and trips outside the prison to search for victims' bodies. It seems likely that neither of the men committed most of the crimes they've confessed to, and eventually they both recant their confessions. But at least some of the murder charges stick. Tool receives 2 death sentences, which are later commuted to life behind bars. But he's never charged in Adam Walsh's death. When he was first arrested for an unrelated crime, Tool's car was impounded, and records note that there were bloodstains inside. After his confession, investigators wanted to test that blood to see if it matches Adam's, but no one can find the vehicle. It's been lost, and with it any hope of proving Tool's guilt. Because despite his bold claims and the chilling details he offers about the crime, Tool never leads investigators to the rest of Adam's remains. For the rest of his life, Otis Tool will remain the key suspect in the case, but in 1996 he will die of cirrhosis, still maintaining his innocence despite his confession. As the years stretch on, getting further and further from the crime that shook families around the country, hope of conclusively finding Adam's killer will fade. Eventually, though, the Walsh family will finally find closure. It's December 16, 2008, in Hollywood, Florida, 27 years after the murder of Adam Walsh. In the police department's bustling press briefing room, authorities prepare to update the media on the status of an infamous case. As the town's police chief steps up to the microphone, the chatter in the room dies down. At the policeman's side are Adam's parents, Reveille and John Walsh. In the years since his son's murder, John has become a nationally recognized figure. Since 1988, he's hosted the long-running America's Most Wanted, which uses reenactments of crimes to encourage viewers to come forward with information that could help locate perpetrators. But today, though, John is in front of the cameras as the father of his murdered child. Cameras flash as the police chief announces that authorities are closing Adam's case, After careful review of all available evidence and with the Walsh's blessing, investigators are satisfied that Otis Toole was responsible for the murder. The announcement marks an end to Adam's story, though not to his legacy. In the years following the young boy's murder, his parents testified before Congress on matters such as victims' rights, missing children, and state criminal laws. They successfully lobbied for legislation to protect children, resulting in the Missing Children Act of 1982, the Missing Children's Assistance Act of 1984, and the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act of 2006. In the 1990s, many department stores and malls across the United States also adopted a system dubbed Code Adam, which mobilizes staff the moment a child is reported missing or found alone in a store. All entrances to the store are locked, with team members posted at each door, and a description of the child is broadcast over the intercom. It will prove a simple but effective tactic to prevent more parents from the pain the Walshes went through when their son's remains were found on August 10, 1981. Next on History Daily, August 11, 1965. Sparked by allegations of police brutality, racial tensions boil over in Los Angeles, igniting the Watts Rebellion. From Noiser and Airship, this is History Daily. Hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham. Audio editing by Mohammed Shazi. Sound design by Molly Bach. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Joel Callan. Executive producers are Alexandra Curry Buckner for Airship and Pascal Hughes for Noiser.